Welcome to Currents, a Norton Rose Fulbright podcast. I'm Todd Alexander, your host and a partner in Norton Rose Fulbright's Projects Group. Today, we're recording with Nick Knapp, Senior Managing Director, and Mike Yerkowich, Directors at CohnReznick. In fact, both these guys are at CohnReznick. They join me today to discuss the development of carbon capture and sequestration projects. Gents, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Todd. Appreciate you having us.
All right. So first, let's talk about what carbon capture and sequestration is, what it is, and why you believe it's an important component of the energy transition. I have seen several projects come across my desk over the last few years. In fact, many years ago, there were a lot of projects that were funded by the U.S. government to see if this even was technically feasible and economically viable. What's the current state of play here? Why do you think that CCS is going to become a bigger part of the energy transition movement?
Thanks, Todd. Yeah, I would say, you know, at CohnReznick Capital, we got pretty vested, you know, in the space as soon as the kind of guidance around 45Q was revamped, and, you know, have been busy betting the market on behalf of, you know, a handful of clients. And, you know, for us, you know, we're a firm driven by sustainability. You know, we think that, you know, carbon capture and sequestration and utilization is a fundamental component of the energy transition. You know, we really take an all of the above approach to help make sure we're moving the needle and supporting our clients in moving the needle. And really, you know, looking at the next 10 to 15 years is critical years in the decarbonization story, and just view it as kind of where we sit today in the renewables landscape, that, you know, there's a long-term transition that will occur. But I think action needs to be taken on the carbon capture side to really hit the goals and get ourselves on track from a decarbonization perspective. And I think that, you know, generally speaking, the market sees that as well and is navigating around that, you know, still in its infancy stages, but, you know, with proven technology. And I think, you know, some level of you know, pilot programs, obviously, throughout the globe here, in terms of proof of concept, really kind of leading the way. I think we expect to see a lot of traction here over the next few years that will look very different than kind of the slow growth on this industry that we've seen so far.
Yeah, to echo what Nick said, we became particularly interested in carbon capture after the Bipartisan Budget Act of 2018 was passed, and the tax credit value was increased to $35 a ton for enhanced oil recovery and other utilization processes, and $50 a ton for pure sequestration in a geologic formation as of 2026. We think the legislation itself helped improve the economics of the projects, you know, broadly across a number of different avenues. And we really think, you know, that the legislation, along with the IRS guidance that has come out over the past couple years here, has set the groundwork for a path for a number of different projects across various technologies to get across the line here and really help reduce the overall carbon emissions, you know, here in the U.S. and really, you know, help shift the landscape towards actually achieving some of the goals that the Biden administration has put forth with a 50% reduction in net greenhouse gases by 2030 relative to 2005 levels and net zero emissions prior to 2050. So carbon capture is really essential to achieving those goals. And there's, you know, various different policies that are currently under consideration that we think could further help advance carbon capture and really drive future growth in the industry.
When you're talking about carbon capture, where are you capturing the carbon? Is this something like you get some big filter system where you're just taking the air and withdrawing carbon from it? Or are we going to power plants? Are we going to other chemical facilities, ethanol plants to get it? Are we just getting it out of rock formations where it's naturally occurring? How do you get the CO2 in the first place? And then secondly, how big of a market is this potentially?
Yeah, certainly. The main opportunities that we have looked at are in the power sector, given that's what we're most familiar with on the renewable energy side. I think the largest two contributors to carbon dioxide emissions in the U.S. are the transportation and the energy sector. I think, you know, from what we've seen in the market, the easier avenues to achieve, you know, carbon capture and sequestration are probably on the lower cost facilities with relatively pure CO2. And typically we see those on the ethanol plants. You know, I think there are other, you know, considerations across a number of different opportunities, natural gas plants, coal plants, biomass facilities, gas processing, as well as, you know, the most interesting, you know, aspect of the energy landscape in the longer term, which is hydrogen.
How many actual carbon capture facilities are there operating now, and how big of a market is this?
I think it's, you know, hard to say. You know, when you mix together kind of the power generation side and the industrial side, you know, I think it's something like 20 to 25 operating facilities. And, you know, I think by various forecasts, right, the numbers are up in the, you know, multi-hundreds to thousands of viable projects globally that we expect to see. And I would say the projects that we've been, you know, investing our time in, you know, are in the $500 million to $1.5 billion CapEx range, you know, and those are on, you know, two or three different projects that we're working on currently. So in terms of the magnitude of projects and the investment required to move these forward, you know, it's a significant scale, especially when, you know, comparing to kind of just the general energy infrastructure and the growth that we've been seeing in general, that this will move the needle, you know, for energy related infrastructure investments.
Is the capital intensive nature of these projects the main thing holding them back, or is the technology really not that proven, or why don't we have more projects already in operation today, given that there's been many people looking at this for a number of years already?
The technology is pretty well developed across a number of different types of opportunities. I think really it's a capital intensive investment. I think the construction time horizon is longer and the development process is longer, given, you know, the various, you know, EPA requirements associated with sequestration of the CO2. And then, you know, there's longer term monitoring requirements as well. I think, you know, the IRS guidance released is helpful to navigate some of those items, but there's still a lot of, you know, early on work that needs to be done before advancing projects. So I do think a number of folks are looking at opportunities, developing projects and taking them to the next stage. And it's really just, it's just a matter of time till we see a bunch more projects across the finish line.
I think prior to the kind of revamping of the credits in 45Q, you know, I don't know that it was all that viable from an economic perspective, right? So that was really the catalyst, I think, to start the momentum. And we did see kind of, you know, we have seen significant momentum ever since. But, you know, clearly with a lot of open questions, you know, to be navigated, which has been the focus and refinement, you know, of what we currently have for policy and ensuring that the, you know, financeability of these projects is there. And I would say kind of just in terms of prior to that date and kind of getting to where we are today, you know, I think the ESG story has really developed, right, to a point that, you know, none of us have experienced before. And so I think when you combine, you know, incentives and clarity in the guidance with the overall evolution of the energy landscape and the energy transition, it provides for, you know, a very good foundation, you know, for this program. And proving to be, you know, fundamental for the transition. And I just don't think we had that momentum, you know, going back a few years ago, even to where we sit today.
So let's talk about the financing and bankability requirements. Let's talk, you mentioned the 45Q credit. Maybe you can talk a little bit about, I know Cohen Resnick's expert in all things tax credit related. So maybe you guys can talk a little bit about what type of emission sources qualify and how valuable the credit is and how to monetize it and kind of the risks associated with it. Because I do agree that most of the inbound questions that we get at Norton Rose, in order to make these projects viable, typically need to figure out a way to monetize that credit.
The projects themselves need to, you know, capture the CO2, and then they need to store it in a safe and permanent environment. Usually that's, a dedicated geologic formation. But the CO2 can also be used for enhanced oil recovery or other utilization processes. I think what really, you know, drives the credits themselves is the increase in value from the revised legislation. And the structure of the tax equity investments will really be very similar to a wind tax equity structure, in that there will be a pay-as-you-go contingent component. The IRS guidance allows for 50% pay-as-you-go as compared to 25% for wind. So there's more flexibility in the timing and amounts of those contributions. Additionally, there is a minimum upfront equity investment of 20%. And so we expect that most of the opportunities will tend to favor a smaller upfront investment by the tax equity investor, with more either, you know, fixed delayed contributions that are fixed in amount and certainty of payment, and then, you know, up to 50% pay-as-you-go contributions. And in doing this, you really generate cash flow that's necessary to cover operating expenses and provide a return to the sponsor. Because if you're doing carbon capture with pure sequestration and storage of CO2 in a geologic formation, there's no alternate revenue stream. And so the only, drive of revenue is really coming from the tax credit itself. And so you need contributions by a tax investor over time to cover those operating expenses.
And when we look at the structure at a high level, right, kind of in reference to the widely known, PTCs under wind with the partnership flip transactions, like Mike had said, I think this will largely mirror what that looks like, with the exception of a potential for smaller upfront contributions to further de-risk the performance from an investor's perspective. And so they're going to price out a mutually agreed upon after-tax IRR for the target flip. And, these credits will run for 12 years. And so the target flip date likely being kind of right at the expiration of the PTCs in year 12. And so you're going to size the upfront investment and the ongoing allocations, based on achieving that stated IRR at that target flip date.
In all things tax equity related to wind and solar, there's always the question of how to secure tax equity for projects. The sponsors always come on the podcast and, discuss the kind of the dearth of readily available tax equity investors. Given that there's plenty of demand for tax equity in proven technologies and wind and solar and other renewables that can receive the benefits from tax equity credits, how much interest is there from the tax equity community in doing a CCS project, and have any actually closed yet?
Yeah, we think there is significant interest from the traditional tax equity investor market. So for the folks that have been around for 10 years plus investing in production tax credits on wind, we think a lot of them will carry over and are mobilized around carbon capture projects. It's you know, certainly a benefit in terms of the income profile and from a tax capacity perspective, you know, having the credits spread out over your a 12-year horizon as opposed to, you know, an investment tax credit up front in year one, which is, you know, significant in terms of the exacerbating on the tax capacity. So it's certainly a question of, you know, when you look at the potential scale of the market of, is there enough tax capacity in the market? I think long-term, that's a serious question that is, you know, we think there needs to be, you know, either an increase in the number of investors, which, you know, we do continue to see over recent years, and we think will continue just as it relates to the ESG perspective here and more, you know, banks and insurance companies coming to this space, but especially on the corporate side, where it's, you know, driven from the C-suite down to help move the needle in the sustainability spectrum, that it should provide, you know, pretty good help on getting the initial projects to the finish line. And I think, you know, when you look at the kind of legacy banks involved in the space, they're certainly mobilized. They're certainly vetting opportunities, you know, as we speak, and can provide, you know, really good color in terms of what they need from a risk return perspective. I'm not aware, I'm not sure if Mike is of any tax equity financings that have closed to date, but I am aware of several that are underway right now.
What about expanding the market for tax credits to new entrants that aren't financial players, like people who understand enhanced oil recovery and have predictable income that they would want to be able to shield with the investment tax credit? I shouldn't say investment tax credit, I should say production tax credit.
That's right, Todd. I think from the traditional energy market, right, there are certainly, you know, oil and gas and midstream players that, you know, do have some level of tax base to self-monetize, but in most cases, it's still going to require, you know, a third-party traditional tax equity structure. I think they can help in taking a piece of the tax benefits, but at the size we're talking about, you know, it's unlikely that we're going to see a lot of, you know, tax-efficient stories from a sponsor perspective. But I think naturally, you know, those folks that understand this market and already, you know, are well positioned to be optimistic and really work on projects that are in their backyard and that will benefit from this make a lot of sense. I think when you move outside of the strategic angle, I think there is a bit of a lag from the corporates that have come into the solar and wind market in terms of coming in and mobilizing around carbon capture and 45Q. But, you know, we do believe that the story around how critical this is, generally speaking, will resonate, and we would expect to see many pivot, you know, into this space. Still a question from a scale perspective, especially in a growing market, and especially if we have a wider policy, fiscal policy around tax credit support with infrastructure and storage. When you look at offshore wind, you know, picking up, the supply, you know, of the projects will certainly continue to be greater than the supply of tax equity. We would see and expect to see a fight to quality as we do in every other industry as well. So, you know, and I think that goes into the conversation around additional incentives and the potential to see direct pay come through. I think when you look at the broad landscape, that becomes even more critical to make this viable at the scale that we should see and expect to see.
One risk, if I remember from looking at these projects in the past that we haven't touched on, is that I think there's greater recapture risk than there are in wind and in solar, if I remember correctly, if the CO2 actually is released, and that has held up some projects. Is that still part of the current structure that's used? And if so, how does that work?
Yeah, the most recent regulations that came out from the IRS improved the recapture period. It was reduced to a 3-year look back for potential recapture of credits. So I think that's an improvement. There still is a long-term monitoring requirement for decades beyond the end of the tax credit period. And so I think that's an area where the cost of that monitoring, will need to be, determined and calculated and weighed relative to a project's economics.
Does that also lead to these type of credits being best monetized by well-capitalized sponsors? So that, because you were mentioning the cost of installing the system in the first place, and then now you have these long-term expenses that maybe a small startup can't incur or can't bear, or is it not the case?
There are a few different avenues to help protect against recapture in particular. One is there are a number of insurance providers that are willing to, or I should say are evaluating the Section 45Q tax credits and providing some form of recapture insurance. Additionally, the project that captures the carbon does not need to be the entity that sequesters the carbon or utilizes it for enhanced oil recovery. So there can be a counterparty that is responsible for storing the CO2 and or using it for enhanced oil recovery or other processes. And that entity, may be able to provide some form of coverage on the credit side to a less well-capitalized sponsor.
Generally, these larger sponsors who are looking to develop these projects, what type of return do you think that they're targeting in order to make the investment worthwhile? And similarly, to get tax equity interested, what type of returns do you think they need as opposed to the type of returns that they could get from doing a wind project?
Thanks, Todd. I think on the sponsor side, the returns will vary probably pretty dramatically based on the technology. But I would suspect, certainly returns would be in the double digits, if not, mid teens or higher, depending on what the ultimate technology is. On the tax equity side, we would expect, based on our conversations with a number of different investors, that the returns to the tax equity investor would be at least a 250 basis point premium to the tax equity returns for renewable energy projects across wind and solar. So I'd say that really puts you in the 8 to 12% range, based on our estimates and where we've seen folks put proposals out into the market. There are a number of investors on the tax equity side that are looking at carbon capture for premium returns north of those values, but it remains to be seen where deals actually get executed on and transacted at.
We'd expect to see, I think the risk premium side of it, decrease as more projects are commercialized and financed. But certainly, we expect to see this premium play out. I think the ranges that Mike had said, completely agree with. And just to ground that, like for a wind deal in today's market, you're anywhere from say 5.5% to 8%, covering kind of the full spectrum for the after-tax yield requirement. So I think kind of looking at that as a, at least 200 bips, but likely 250 bips and higher is what we expect to see. Now that can be managed, right? And it will be different based on each project and the risk profile of each project. But additionally on the sponsor standing behind the project and how well capitalized they are to support some of the uncertainty that you may see on these projects. And I think when you combine that, with the benefit of additional contingent payments through the pay-as-you-go structure and the deferred contributions, it does provide for you know, significant de-risking that you don't have to the same extent, you know, on the wind side. So it is kind of just the proof of concept where we'd expect to see these premiums, but would, I think, over time see them converge with the broader, you know, tax credit landscape and renewable energy landscape.
All right, last question for you guys. You touched on direct pay already. What type of either reforms do you think are needed to make CCS more common? Or if you think the current structure is, you know, is viable and it's just a question of time, that's good. And then what additional support, if any, do you think is coming out of Washington this year?
That's a great question. I think there are a number of different proposals that are under consideration. And ultimately, what comes out of Washington could be, you know, in a very, you know, different landscapes than what we expect. But I do think the initial proposal from the Green Act included direct pay at 85 cents on the dollar. There was, you know, a revised widened proposal that had dollar for dollar direct pay. And then there's a newer proposal under the CATCH Act, the CATCH Emissions Reduction Act, that would further bolster carbon capture by increasing the value of the tax credit itself for both carbon capture and sequestration and use in enhanced oil recovery. And so I think, you know, the combination of direct payments with an increase of the value of the tax credit would certainly enhance the economic viability across a number of different projects and technology types, and really help with the overall carbon reductions across the United States. I do not have an inside scoop on where the legislation will ultimately shake out, though.
All right. Well, I guess we'll see. I don't think anybody has an inside scoop at this point. I don't think anybody knows where even the current infrastructure bill is headed. If you see how it's been meandering through different proposals here over the last several months. So anyway, well, I guess we'll all stand by and in the meantime, hope that the existing 45Q credit together with ESG focus allow some of these CCS projects to finally get built and operational. So thanks guys for joining today. And maybe the next time you're on here, we'll have five or six new projects to talk about.
We hope so, Todd. We really appreciate it.
Thank you, Todd.
You can find us online at www.projectfinance.law or send us an email at currents@nortonrosefulbright.com. Please rate, review, and subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your preferred podcast app. Our show today was produced by Emily Rogers.
Stay ahead of the currents.